You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
All right, the book of 1 Samuel. This is the eighth or ninth book in our Bibles. We're going to start a series on the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. Originally, this was all one book. They had to split it up into two just because the size of a scroll could only hold so much. The author is a guy named Samuel, a guy we'll meet tonight. He was a prophet. He would have been the author for the first part of this, but then at a certain point, he passes off the scene, and other prophets pick up the quill and record the history from then on forward. We see a different list of prophets, for example, in 1 Chronicles 29. This records a very important period in Israel's history. So when we move back to the Old Testament, we're going to focus more on the ancient nation of Israel, a people that God called together for a purpose. And if we just look at a timeline here, the Old Testament ends around 400 BCE. And this nation of Israel, the story of the nation of Israel, starts around 2000 BCE with a guy named Abraham. This is a guy who God picked, and God said, I am going to make you a father of many, and I'm going to make your descendants into a huge nation. And all of the other nations of the world are going to be blessed through one of your descendants. He also promised them a specific land, which is the modern-day nation of Israel. The Jewish people live there today. And so God made a very important promise to Abraham, and the rest of the Old Testament is kind of the outworking of that promise, and it leads all the way into the New Testament. Well, a few hundred years go by, and the sons and daughters of Abraham have grown and grown and grown and grown. And then they go down to Egypt, and we studied the book of Exodus a few months ago right here in this CT. And they spent many hundreds of years in Egypt. They became even bigger. They became slaves. And God sent a guy named Moses around 1500 BC to lead the people out of slavery and into this land that he had picked out for them. Well, what happens next after the book of Judges, after the book of Exodus, is they receive the Ten Commandments. And God begins to reveal things about himself to these people. But then, after they move into the promised land, you know, the sons of Abraham, the people of Abraham, they were divided into tribes. And the different tribes, they occupy different parts of the land, and they each sort of drift away from each other. It's a pretty disorganized time, and this is known as the time of the judges. It's a pretty dark time morally for the nation of Israel, one of the darkest in their history. The final verse in the book of Judges says, in those days, Israel had no king, and all the people did whatever seemed right in their own eyes. And so it was not a good time. But then we reach around 1100 BCE, and that's when the book of 1 Samuel picks up. And by the end of 2 Samuel, only a little over 100 years go by, and yet the nation is radically different. This, at this point, has become a nation. And this nation has a guy on the throne named King David, who at the end of 2 Samuel is at the end of a long, fruitful reign, a very powerful king. He was a ruler over the whole nation. They're not divided into separate tribes anymore, but they all come together as one solid nation. They also are based out of Jerusalem. Tonight we're going to see the action take place in a town called Shiloh. They've moved to Jerusalem. Jerusalem wasn't even a thing when 1 Samuel starts, and it's the capital of Israel by the end of 2 Samuel. Also, there's not a temple yet, but David has promised to build a temple. He's gathered all of the materials for it. He's purchased the land for the temple, and his son Solomon would build that temple. That becomes very important. Tonight, the worship of Israel is centered in this tent called a tabernacle. By the end of 2 Samuel, they've moved to a temple. And then finally, there's a new promise. You know, the promise to Abraham that I'm going to make you into a great nation and all the nations of the world will be blessed through one of your descendants. He makes an additional, just as important promise to David. And what he promises, he says, you know, you're the king of Israel, David. But he says, one day, one of your descendants will sit on a throne and rule forever. Very important promise that he adds to that. And ultimately, that promise that one of your descendants will sit on a throne and will rule forever, that was fulfilled in Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, who lived a perfect life, who died for the sins of the world, and then he rose from the dead, and he sits in heaven now, and one day he will come back in bodily form, and he will reign, and he will set up an eternal kingdom. We talked a lot about that in the book of 2 Thessalonians. And so What happens in between 1100 BC and 970 BCE, the books of 1st and 2nd Samuel? They narrate this very important shift in pretty much every way for the nation of Israel. So let's just start reading. 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1. Samuel tells us there was a man named Elkanah, as it's pronounced, who lived in Ramah in the region of Ziph, in the hill country of Ephraim. So if you look at a map of Israel, you can see the Dead Sea there kind of on the bottom, the Sea of Galilee up in the top. Ephraim would have been this strip of land right across the middle. This guy and his family, they lived in the rugged hill country of Ephraim, but they were not from the tribe of Ephraim. They were actually from the tribe of Levi. There was one specific tribe from Israel, and that was picked to be the priestly tribe. And these would be scattered throughout the cities of all the other tribes, and they would be in charge of making sure the worship of God was done properly, according to the way God wanted it done. And so, not all of the Levites were priests, but all the priests were Levites. And so this guy was from the tribe of Levi, and we read that Elkanah had two wives, Hannah and Peninnah. Hannah and Peninnah. Why did he have two wives? Well, polygamy is not God's ideal. We see from the very first pages of Scripture that when God designed marriage, he said marriage is supposed to be between one man, one woman. It's supposed to be a lifelong commitment. All sexual activity is supposed to be done within marriage. We see Jesus in Matthew 19 repeat God's original design for marriage. And so God did permit polygamy in the Old Testament, but what becomes clear is every time you see a guy take more than one wife, things go very poorly for him and for the family. You know, one wife is plenty, according to God. And even though he permits it, and we're going to see this is going to cause problems in his family. Even though God permits it in the Old Testament, it's not good. And by the time we get to the New Testament, it's explicitly forbidden for Christians who want to be Christian leaders. Why did he take a second wife? Well, I think Samuel tells us in the second part of verse 2. Peninnah had children, but Hannah did not. What would happen sometimes is if your wife couldn't have kids, you would just take another wife. Infertility is painful enough. There's a tremendous amount of shame, a tremendous amount of disappointment, hoping that we will get pregnant, and then sometimes even getting pregnant, but then the baby doesn't make it to term, or the baby's born, and then the baby passes away. Infertility can be incredibly painful, and this would have added even more pain to Hannah's life. You know, here she's looking around, and she's like, well, he took another woman, and she's able to have kids. I guess we know where the problem is with me. Everybody else would have been looking at her saying, I guess we know what the problem is here. It's you. She might have wondered, did I do something wrong? Is this some kind of punishment? Like, is there something wrong with me? Tremendous amount of shame. She would have felt defective. And now she's got to deal with Peninnah. You know, her husband takes another wife. She just starts popping out the kids. She has to live in this household where there's all these kids running around that aren't hers. They're reminders of her failure. They're reminders that her husband had to take another woman. You know, some nights he's in bed with her, some nights he's in bed with the other one. Tremendous amount of sorrow. Tremendous amount of sorrow for Hannah. She would have lived a rough life, a difficult life. And, you know, part of what it was her culture had an ideal standard for women. You know, women were supposed to do certain things. Women were supposed to be a certain way. She was supposed to be able to have children, to pass on the family line. And she simply could not live up to her culture's standards for what a woman is supposed to be and do. And it caused her a tremendous amount of pain. And perhaps some of us can relate to her on this. Each year, Elkanah would travel to Shiloh to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of Heaven's armies at the tabernacle. Let's talk about this. Shiloh and the tabernacle. So Shiloh would have been a little town right here, just northern part of the region of Ephraim. And if you're driving down a highway in Israel today, you might see this sign right here, ancient Shiloh. They found this place. Like so many of the places in the Bible, these are not mythology set in a galaxy far, far away. No, it's Shiloh. We know where it is. You can see the archaeological sites were often higher places because more cities would keep getting built on top of the old ones. But you can see from kind of an overhead view here, the different layers that they've excavated here. You can walk the streets of ancient Shiloh. You can see where they think the tabernacle would have been. It's possible at this point, and our text actually calls the tabernacle a temple in a few places. It's possible that they had built some sort of partially permanent structures. But the original tabernacle, we see God prescribed in the Old Testament in the book of Exodus, it would have looked something like this. It would have been a tent, and there would have been a giant altar out front. And inside the tent, that would have been, there was two rooms. There was the holy place, and then the holy of holies, or the most holy place. And inside that second room, inside that tent, this was a place where symbolically only God was. This is where God symbolically dwelt, even though they knew God didn't live there. And only the high priest could go in there only one day a year for a very special ceremony. But part of the message was, we need some distance. You can't just come into the presence of God. But people would come here, and there were priests, including a high priest, that were in charge. And they would take people sacrifices, and they were supposed to teach people about God. It was a very high standard had to be upheld here. Here's one artist rendering of what Shiloh may have looked like. You can kind of see there the temple, tabernacle area. About 1400 BCE in Joshua 18, it says they set up the tabernacle there at Shiloh. It was kind of a central place where all the tribes could get to pretty equally. Kenneth Kitchen tells us that this was actually destroyed, this area, around 1050 BCE, which fits perfectly with the timeline of the book of 1 Samuel. It fits perfectly with the events that we will see next week about a disaster that happens to the Ark of the Covenant. And we shouldn't be surprised by this because the stories in the Bible are real. They really happened. And this should strengthen our faith when we find things like this. Well, it says the priests of the Lord at that time, the priests of Yahweh, were the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas. So here's another family we're going to meet that are going to play a role in the events of this study and the one that comes next week. Yeah, Eli, his sons Hophni and Phinehas, they were also Levites. He would have been the high priest at the time. His sons also served as priests. This family had been given a very tremendous spiritual responsibility to take care of the tabernacle, to oversee the worship there. They had people working for them. Surely they would take such a responsibility seriously, wouldn't you think? Well, we'll see. Well, there were days where Elkanah would go to present his sacrifice at Shiloh. And he would give portions of the meat to Peninnah and to each of her children. And the meat here, by the way, this was a pretty rare treat in a poor society. You know, the way God set up the sacrifices of the tabernacle was unlike pagan religion. In pagan religion, the sacrifices were to feed the gods because the gods were hungry, like us. God says, look, I don't need to eat, okay? And even if I did, I wouldn't come and talk to you about it. I own the cattle on 1,000 hills, he says in Psalm 50. No, what God said was, when you bring a sacrifice, a portion of it, there were different kinds, but you know, a portion would be offered up to God. Parts would go to the priests to support the, you know, they needed to eat as well. And then the rest of it, he said, I want the person who brought the meat to have a big old cookout. Okay? And so these annual festivals where they would go, it was like having a big barbecue. It was like July 4th cookout. And they would go and they would eat. And God said, I want your trips to the tabernacle to be the funnest times of the year for you and your whole family. You're taking off work. You're traveling. You're going to have the biggest feast of the year. And I want you to have a good time. And so here they are at this joyous occasion. And Hannah's sitting there. And all these kids that aren't hers are running around and everybody's having their meat, including Peninnah. And it says, even though he loved Hannah, he'd give her only one choice portion because Yahweh had given her no children. So Peninnah would taunt Hannah and make fun of her because Yahweh had kept her from having children. The text tells us not once but twice, Yahweh, God, was the reason she didn't have kids. And we wonder what kind of a cruel God would do such a thing to this poor woman. What had she done wrong? You know, there's a lot of reasons for infertility. In this case, God was the one blocking it. And you think, why, God? Why would you be so mean to her that you would block her from something? This was causing her so much pain. And she had waited so long, many, many, many years, through the taunts of Peninnah and just the looks of society. She was suffering here. And God says to you who are suffering, my ways are far beyond anything you could imagine. When we're suffering, when we feel like God is cruel, we feel like God doesn't hear us, God says, there are some things you don't know here, some things that I am doing. And what we will see is that Hannah does not respond like a lot of people would, to shake her fist at God, to turn her back on God, to take things into her own hands through some other means. No. She trusts God, and she actually becomes a model of how to suffer and how to cling to God in the midst of our suffering. And I'll be honest, Hannah's one of my favorite people in the whole Bible, okay? I think she's great. And I hope you guys see why tonight as we read her story. Well, year after year, it was the same. Peninnah would taunt Hannah as they went to the tabernacle. Each time, Hannah would be reduced to tears and would not even eat. It's supposed to be a happy occasion. And here, Elkanah's showing up. Elkanah, he's trying to have a good time here at this festival, and his wife is crying. Why are you crying, Hannah? Elkanah would ask. He was very confused. Why aren't you eating? Why be downhearted just because you have no children? I mean, you have me. Isn't that better than having 10 sons? Okay, guys, we got to do better than this, all right? I know it's confusing. She's having feelings. Really, just you don't even really have to say anything, okay? I mean, if he would have just sat there and listened to her and asked her how she was feeling instead of suggesting solutions and explaining why he is all that she needs. It's also, I think, a note here, women. Men cannot meet your deepest needs. There's a place in your heart that cannot be met by men. It can only be met by God. I remember when my wife and I, we were in premarital counseling before we got married, and our counselor turned to her and said, you know, men can make wonderful husbands, but terrible gods. That's always stuck with us. And the same is true for guys as well. Women can make wonderful wives, but terrible gods or goddesses for you. You must look to God to meet your needs. And then, once God is at the center, once God comes first, then you're in a place to enjoy relationships, enjoy the other good things that God puts in your life, including, possibly, God willing, a marriage, including, possibly, God willing, a family. But Hannah, we see, has many painful voices in her life. She has the voice of Peninnah, the voice of her culture saying, you loser, you loser. You haven't done what women are supposed to be. You are not who women are supposed to be. The shame. You have her husband, who's, I think, well-meaning, but kind of insensitive. She would have been kind of lonely. And so where does she turn? Where does she turn? She turns to the only place we should turn when we're faced with something like this. It says, once after a sacrificial meal at Shiloh, Hannah got up and she went to pray. Hannah turns to God in the midst of her pain. She goes into the tabernacle, into the first room of that tent. They apparently had more access back then. I mean, it was the time of the judges, after all. And Eli the priest was sitting at his customary place beside the entrance of the tabernacle, or it says temple in some of our Bibles, again, I think, because maybe they had built some few permanent pieces to this structure at this point. Hannah was in deep anguish, crying bitterly as she prayed to Yahweh. Here she is. She's not even hiding it anymore. She's in this tent. She's talking to God. She is sobbing because this pain has been building up in her life for years. And it finally breaks. And she turns to Yahweh. And she made this vow. Lord Almighty, she says. For the first time in the Bible, this phrase appears on someone's lips. If you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me, your servant, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to Yahweh for all the days of his life. And no razor will ever be used on his head. That's a Nazarite vow from Numbers chapter 6. In fact, there was a guy named Samson who was a judge who was probably still alive in a different part of Israel running around, who also was a pretty famous Nazarite who never cut the hair on his head until he did. But that's another story. And so she dedicates her son to God, to the service in the temple. You know, some people look at this and they're like, oh, is she bargaining with God here? Is this some kind of pagan ritual? No, she's not bargaining with God. You know, if she was bargaining with God, why does she call herself your servant three different times in her prayer? If she was bargaining with God because she wanted a son, why would she immediately give the son to God as soon as she gets him? No, she would say, give me a son and I'll do something else for you. But I wonder if she had some sort of a prompting from God that this child would be special, that this child would have a special place in God's plan. And so she offers her child up to God. No, she's not bargaining with God. In fact, Hannah is portrayed as perhaps the most godly woman in the Old Testament. She's the only woman who has said, who a narrative tells us goes up to the temple, the place of God, to pray. She's the only woman who we have a narrative of praying. Her prayer is one of the longest prayers in the entire Old Testament. And unlike other women that have fertility issues, she doesn't resort to her own schemes. She turns to God and cries and pours her heart out and just simply asks him, God, can you solve this problem? And as she was praying to Yahweh, Eli watched her. And so we see the high priest witnessing her prayer. And as Eli opens his mouth to speak, we realize that Hannah is completely surrounded by insensitive men. Seeing her lips moving but hearing no sound, he thought she'd been drinking. Must you come here drunk? Throw away your wine! She's like, oh, why are you yelling at me? She's wiping the tears. He couldn't recognize someone praying because drunkenness was a problem in the tabernacle in those days. Oh, no, sir, I haven't been drinking wine or anything stronger. I'm very discouraged. I was pouring my heart out to Yahweh. Don't think of your servant as a wicked woman. I've been praying out of great anguish and sorrow. Her eyes puffy, her cheeks were red. Oh, well, in that case, go in peace. May the God of Israel grant whatever request you asked of him. And yet she knew. Something in her heart told her, God has answered my prayer. And she says, may your servant find favor in your eyes. And then she went back and began to eat again, and she was no longer sad. Notice the order here. She prays to God, and then she has peace. And then later, she sees the answer to the prayer. She sees the pregnancy. It's not prayer, pregnancy, peace. Prayer, peace. Pregnancy. She has left her burdens with God. She has trusted his answer, and she says, I know it's as good as done, because God has said yes. The entire family got up the next morning and went to worship Yahweh once more, and then they returned home to Ramah. And when Elkanah slept with Hannah, Yahweh remembered her plea. Not that God had like forgotten or something like that, but that just means, it means God decided it was time to act on his promise. And in due time, she gave birth to a son. And she named him Samuel, heard by God or asked of God, for she said, I have asked Yahweh for him. And so God answers Hannah's prayer. And isn't it interesting, you know, there's 19 verses describing the problem and the agony and the waiting, and then a half a verse for the answer. And God's answers can come quickly, no matter how long and painful the waiting has been. They often can come pretty quick. And that's the case for Hannah. Well, the next year, Elkanah and his family went on their annual trip to offer a sacrifice to Yahweh and to keep his vow, and now it's time. Is she going to offer her boy? But Hannah did not go. She told her husband, no, let's wait till the boy's weaned, and then I'll take him to the tabernacle and leave him there with Yahweh permanently until the boy is weaned. Well, whatever you think is best, stay here for now, and may Yahweh help you keep your promise. So she stayed home and nursed the boy until he was weaned. That would have been about 3 or so years back in this culture. And that would have been 3 years that went far too fast for Hannah. These precious moments with her baby boy, watching him take his first steps, watching him say his first words, seeing him smile, memorizing every feature of his face, noting his little dimple, noting his things that just set him apart from other children. These would have been sweet times, and yet she would have known, this time is limited. I only have a short time with my son here. Remember, only God heard her vow. This was not something that even Eli knew. She could have just gone back on it, but she didn't. No, she told her husband. I don't know what that conversation was like, but he agreed to go along with it. That's good from Elkanah. She would have told Samuel at some point, even though he could not understand. She would have told him, you're going to live with me for a little while, and then you're going to go live with somebody else. And God's got big plans for your life. She would have taught Samuel about God during these years. She would have prayed with Samuel, prayed for Samuel. And we will see that Hannah's love for him and her teaching left its imprint on Samuel. He's writing about it here in the book of 1 Samuel. And this is what will keep him during some difficult times in the household of Eli. Well, when the child was weaned, Hannah took him to the tabernacle in Shiloh, and they brought a 3-year-old bull for the sacrifice and a basket of flour and some wine. And after sacrificing the bull, they brought the boy to Eli. And can you hear the lump in her throat, and can you see the tears in her eyes as she opens her mouth and says, sir, do you remember me? I'm the woman who stood here several years ago praying to Yahweh, and I asked Yahweh to give me this boy, and he has granted my request, and now I'm giving him to Yahweh, and he will belong to Yahweh his whole life. And I'm sure she got down, and she said, you know, this is going to be your new dad for now. We'll come see you, but you're going to stay here for now, and gave him a hug, gave him a kiss, sent him on his way to his new home. And the only way she could do this is because she was strengthened by God to do that. She had wrestled this out with God, wrestled through his promises. And Hannah, at this point, it says, she prayed. A very famous prayer. We don't have time to go through the whole thing. But the gist of it is this. My heart rejoices in Yahweh. Yahweh has made me strong. He lifts the poor from the dust and the needy from the garbage dump. He sets them among princes, placing them in seats of honor. For all the earth is Yahweh's, and he has set the world in order. You know, Hannah's prayer, it focuses on God's sovereignty, God's grace toward the helpless. This is the message of the Bible, God's grace. You know, some people think the Bible says good people go to heaven and bad people go to hell. That's not what it says. It says everybody's bad. No one has met God's standard, but God gives grace through Jesus to whoever admits they need it. And Hannah was one such person. This prayer is practically quoted by Mary, the mother of Jesus, when she finds out that she is pregnant with Jesus, the future Savior. She quotes heavily from Hannah's prayer. Jesus echoes this throughout his ministry by saying, the last shall be first and the first shall be last. It's backward in the kingdom of God. Society exalts the powerful, but God exalts the humble. And Paul writes, God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before God. That's how God works. Hannah, in the grand scheme of things, and even by her culture's standards, was so meaningless. And yet God used her and her suffering and her prayers and her sacrifice to change the course of biblical history, to change the course of the nation of Israel, to do something great. How many of the great things in history are built on the prayers of small, insignificant people? We'll only find out when we get to heaven. Well, Elkanah returned home without Samuel, and the boy served Yahweh by assisting Eli the priest. Now, the sons of Eli were actually scoundrels who had no respect for Yahweh. They were terrible people, as it turns out. This is the home that Samuel is going into. No respect for Yahweh or their duties as priests. Whenever anyone offered a sacrifice, the Eli's sons would send a servant over with a 3-pronged fork. While the meat of the sacrificed animal was still boiling, the servant would stick the fork into the pot and demand that whatever it brought up be given to Eli's sons. So they're skimming off the tops of the sacrifices, taking more than was their fair share. All the Israelites who came to worship at Shiloh were treated this way. They come here to meet God, to learn about God, and instead, there are wicked, corrupt leaders taking advantage of them. Sometimes the servant would come even before the animal's fat had been burned on the altar, and he would demand raw meat before it had been boiled so it could be used for roasting in direct disobedience to the law. You know, why do they want the meat before it had been boiled? Well, have you ever had boiled steak? It's not that good. Roasted meat, though, that's pretty good. They're like, oh, I think it'd be better. Who cares what God says? I want my meat roasted. I want some roasted goat, not boiled. The man offering the sacrifice, they might even know their Bible. They might say, well, you can take as much as you want, but the fat must be burned first. No, give it to me now or I'll take it by force. These guys were bullies. So the sin of these young men was very serious in Yahweh's sight, for they treated Yahweh's offerings with contempt. Spiritual leaders abusing their positions of power. Why are we not surprised when this happens even today? It's really pretty sad how some people will move into places where they should represent God, and instead they use it for selfish gain. But Samuel, though he was only a boy, served Yahweh. And each year, his mother would visit him, and she would make a small little coat for him, a little bit bigger each year, and she would bring it to him when she came with her husband for the sacrifice. Hey, Samuel, I got you a coat. Keep you warm at night. And before they returned home, Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife, and he would say, may Yahweh give you other children to take the place of this one she gave to Yahweh. And wouldn't you know, Yahweh blessed Hannah, and she conceived, and she gave birth to 3 sons and 2 daughters. And meanwhile, Samuel grew up in the presence of Yahweh. And so this is the other part of Hannah's story, the end of her story. God came through after all. All those long years of waiting when God seemed so cruel, God was doing something. And in the end, God was proven generous and good. And she was rewarded for her faithfulness to him. And God promises, I will always reward everyone for their faithfulness to me in the end, even if that end is maybe the next life. You may even get some stuff here in this life. On the other hand, her son was growing up in the presence of Yahweh. And even though he grew up in a home where there were problems, he was not supposed to learn from Hophni and Phinehas. And yet God preserved him through the prayers of his family, through the teachings of his mother, even from a young age. That should give us hope. Now, Eli was very old, but he was aware of what his sons were doing to the people of Israel. Oh, he knew. In fact, it's worse than we thought. He knew, for instance, that his sons were seducing the young women who assisted at the entrance of the tabernacle. So these women would offer their service up to God, and the next thing they know, they're being pressured into sex with the priests. You know, this was pagan religion. You'd go and you'd have sex with a priestess as part of your worship of God. And God wanted nothing to do with that. God holds sex in a very high place. And yet these guys, not only were they stealing, but they were also using people they were supposed to be serving sexually. Eli confronts them finally. Finally, I've been hearing reports from all the people about the wicked things you're doing. Why do you keep sinning? You must stop, my sons. The reports I hear among Yahweh's people are not good. But Eli's sons wouldn't listen to their father, for Yahweh was already planning to put them to death. God said, I know they're not going to listen, and I got to take these guys out. High standards for leaders. High standards here. Why do you keep sinning? You know what's missing, though, from Eli's little speech here? How about you're fired? How about taking these guys out of leadership and putting somebody in there who actually respects God? But he couldn't do that. Failure to discipline. You know, God's definition of love sometimes includes discipline. We've got to understand that. People need encouragement. People need help. But it's not enough just to do those things. Sometimes they need to be corrected for their own good. And Eli just couldn't do that. He missed his chance with his kids. Discipline your children while there's hope. Otherwise, you'll ruin their lives, we read in the Proverbs. And so there's a time. There's a time for the hard word. There's a time for limits. There's time to say enough. And Eli couldn't do that. Not with his own kids, anyway. Well, one day, a man of God, a prophet, came to Eli and gave him this message from Yahweh. Why do you scorn my sacrifices and offerings, Eli? Why do you give your sons more honor than you give me? For you and they have become fat from the best offerings of my people Israel. So why was he so permissive with them? Well, we learn one thing here. Eli was benefiting from their corruption. He says, it's not just your kids that are getting fat here. You're getting fat, Eli, off of the meat that you're stealing from the people that should be sacrificed and the rest of it go back to them. So Eli's like, maybe. And he also says, you're giving your sons more honor than you give me. He had a priority problem in his life. It should have been God and then my kids. And instead it was my kids and then God. And when you get those reversed, you can't love your kids. In fact, I remember a long time ago, someone said to me, the best thing you can do to love your kids is to love God more than you love your kids. God has to come first in every part of our lives, and the other things arranged around what God has to say. Eli was not doing that. Therefore, Yahweh, the God of Israel, says, I promise that your branch of the tribe of Levi would always be my priests. But the time's coming when I'll put an end to your family, so it will no longer serve as my priests. You guys have blown it. You're going to lose your position of service, your important position. All the members of your family will die before their time. And to prove what I said will come true, I'll cause your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, to die on the same day. We'll see that next week, actually. And then I will raise up a faithful priest who will serve me and do what I desire. I'll build him an everlasting house, and he will walk before my anointed always. A prediction. Who's he talking about? Well, there's a near-term fulfillment and a long-term fulfillment of this. The near-term here, he's going to raise up a guy named Zadok. He's become a priest. He's from a different line from the original family of Levi. And God says, I'm actually going to work through Zadok and the priests that come from his lineage. You've blown it, Eli. You could have had a role in my plan. But the ultimate fulfillment is not just fulfilled in Zadok, but ultimately, God would raise up Jesus Christ. Not only is he the king that will rule forever, but he's also a high priest who will serve forever. He's the only high priest. He's the last high priest we will ever need. And he is the one who is the mediator between mankind and the Father. And so ultimately, this does point to Christ, and it will be fulfilled in the New Testament and in the future. And then we come to chapter 3. And it says, meanwhile, the boy Samuel served Yahweh by assisting Eli. Samuel begins to grow up. As we move into chapter 3, Samuel, it doesn't tell us how old he is. He's probably 8 to 13 years old. Let's call him 10 for this story. Let's call him 10 or 11. Now, in those days, messages from Yahweh were very rare, and visions were quite uncommon. I mean, the leaders are corrupt. They're not listening anyway. But that's all about to change. It says, one night, Eli, who was almost blind by now, had gone to bed. The lamp of God had not yet gone out, and Samuel was sleeping in the tabernacle near the ark of God. So the lamp, this was this menorah, this lamp that would burn all night long. And so even though it's dark outside, Samuel's in the tabernacle. He might have been sleeping there in the very spot where his mother prayed for him so many years before with tears. And he's there. He's as close as you can get to the ark of God in the tabernacle. And the light is shining in the darkness. And suddenly, as he slept, he was awoken by God calling. It says, suddenly Yahweh called out, Samuel. Samuel replied, here I am. He got up, he ran to Eli. Here I am, did you call me? Eli's like, what time is it? I didn't call you, go back to bed. And so he did. Falls back asleep. And then Yahweh called out again, Samuel. Again, Samuel got up. He went to Eli. Wake, here I am. Did you call me? And Eli's like, oh my gosh. What? No, I didn't call you, my son. Go back to bed. Everybody goes back to sleep. Samuel did not yet know Yahweh because he had never heard a message from Yahweh before. He didn't know what his voice sounded like. Yahweh calls a third time. And once more, Samuel got up and he went to Eli. Here I am. Did you call me? What's going on here? And then Eli realized, even in his spiritually insensitive, nearly blind state, Yahweh was calling the boy. And so he said to Samuel, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go and lie down again. And if someone calls again, here's what you should say. Speak, Yahweh. Your servant is listening. Your servant. And so Samuel went back to bed. And Yahweh came, and this time it says he stood there. And he called as before, but this time twice. Samuel! Samuel! And Samuel, obedient young boy, says, speak. Left out Yahweh for some reason, but says, speak. Your servant is listening. I'm about to do a shocking thing in Israel, Samuel. I'm going to carry out all my threats against Eli and his family from beginning to end. I've warned him that judgment is coming on his family forever because his sons are blaspheming God and he hasn't disciplined them. So I vowed that the sins of Eli and his sons will never be forgiven by sacrifices or offerings. It's too late. He's blown it. I'm moving on. I'm moving on to you, Samuel. It's basically what he's saying here. I don't know how much sleep Samuel got that night. But he writes, Samuel stayed in bed until morning, and then he got up. And he opened the doors of the tabernacle as usual, and you can imagine him opening these. It would have faced east, the sunlight from the sunrise streaming in, and I think Samuel may have known, and something new is happening. This is the dawn of a new era. But he was afraid to tell Eli what Yahweh had said to him. He didn't want to give this message. God had given him an unpleasant message. He didn't want to say that. But Eli called out to him, Samuel, my son. Everybody's calling him lately. Here I am, Samuel replied. Good answer. What did Yahweh say to you? Tell me everything. He suspects. And may God strike you and kill you if you hide anything from me. Okay, that escalated quickly. So Samuel told him everything. He didn't hold anything back, just like a good spokesman for God has to do sometimes, deliver the hard word. Well, Eli replies, it's Yahweh's will. Let him do what he thinks best. Passive again. I don't think it was too late for him to turn. I think God would have alleviated the consequences some if he had. God always seems to do that. But he's like, well, oh well. And Samuel grew up, and Yahweh was with him, and everything he said proved to be reliable. And all Israel, from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south, knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of Yahweh. And that's where we'll draw the line this week. What are the lessons from the story of Samuel? I think there's some lessons from Hannah's life. We've got a lot of voices in our lives telling us we don't meet up to the standard, even mocking voices of others who are insensitive. Maybe there's religious voices in our lives that are misunderstanding us. Will, like Hannah, we cling to God in the face of that? Will we run to him with our pain, no matter how long it's lasted, no matter how hopeless it seems, and just present our empty poverty? Will we be like those that he picks out of the garbage dump and sets in the place of honor? Be like Hannah. Cling to God, and then whatever God gives you, hold it with a loose hand. You've got to keep putting God first. You've got to continually be willing to give back to God what he gives you. And you'll be amazed by his grace. There's the lesson of Eli. Unwilling to discipline. Unwilling to say the hard word. Even benefiting off of the corruption of others. God holds a high standard for leaders. And God also says sometimes love has got to be tough love. Are you willing to exercise tough love? Is there an area God's calling you to do that right now? It's got to be love, but it's got to be tough. And finally, the lesson of Samuel. The lesson of Samuel, which says when God calls, you say, here I am. What do you want? And when God gives you something to say, you say it, even if it's unpleasant. And you keep serving him just like Samuel. We'll see how God unfolds his life. Lord, you're the God that takes the needy out of the garbage dump and puts them in places of honor. I'm thankful for how you have done that in my life. I'm thankful that we've got a room with a lot of people in it who could testify that that's been their experience with you as well, Lord. We thank you that we can trust you, that you're a powerful God and you're a good God, even though we can't see what you're doing a lot of times. I pray for those of us who are suffering, Lord, that we would not quit on you. But I pray that instead we would draw close to you, pour our hearts out to you like we see from Hannah, offer our lives over to you even more in the midst of our suffering, Lord. And I pray we cooperate with your plan. I pray that you would use us to do big things, Lord. And I'm thankful too, God, for how you fulfilled your promise of a great priest forever, not just in the near term for them, but with Christ, who's our priest, the only priest we ever need, and who has cleared the way for us to come to you and talk with you whenever we want, not in a tabernacle through a curtain, but directly in our hearts. So I pray for those who haven't made that decision that they would do so tonight. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.